I always knew that I was going to serve Native people, but here was a chance to make that move to a place where it felt like home and where I would serve my own tribe.
This is Meaningful Medicine. In a challenging and unpredictable world with high burnout rates, this is a podcast where incredible individuals share their most meaningful patient experiences and focus on those moments of positivity and joy that sparked their love of healthcare and changed the way they practice medicine.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hohenstein, and I'm an emergency medicine resident at UCSF.
Hi, I'm Shiva Kayambashi. I'm a doctor and professor of family and community medicine at UCSF.
We're the co-hosts of Meaningful Medicine. We created this podcast to highlight stories of healthcare professionals who have found a sense of meaning, resilience, and joy in their work. Hey, Shiva, how are you doing?
Hi, Nicole. I'm doing really well today, and I'm, you know, so happy to see you and so happy to interview our very special guest today. How are you doing today?
I'm so excited to be talking about Native or Indigenous health today. I am doing really well. I actually somehow wrangled a four-day weekend, which I think never happens. So lots of a wellness, and we just celebrated our wonderful R4s graduating, which is a huge milestone. It was a little weird. A lot of people came up to me and said, congrats. And I looked around and I said, you know, I'm not the one graduating. They're like, no, you've like made it through intern year. So it was very, very surreal for me.
Absolutely, Nicole. I remember that exact feeling at the end of the year graduation for the senior residents, and somebody came to me and said, congratulations. And I thought they mistook me for a senior. I said, no, I'm nowhere near. But the truth is, it is very big to have finished your intern year. And that's what I was told. And that's what you're being told. So I will also echo a huge congratulations to you. It is a big accomplishment. And I know there's a lot to process, and you don't have any time for it, but you have 4 days off. So hopefully you get a little processing time.
Yes, it was quite wonderful. But I'm so excited we get to talk about this really important topic of Native Indigenous health today. I do, before we jump into kind of our background information and before we truly introduce our guest, I want to first off ask our wonderful guest about really how she and her community would prefer us to address her community, whether it be the Indigenous population, Native American population. And so I do want to humbly ask how we should refer to your community in our topic today.
Yes, thank you so much. And I'm really honored to be interviewed on this Meaningful Medicine podcast. And I want to thank you so much for asking me. And congratulations, Nicole, for your milestone completion. That's really wonderful. So as far as terms, yes, I would prefer the term Native or Indigenous. I think that that more accurately describes our relationship to this continent.
Thank you. And to our listeners who don't know who that wonderful person was, I'll just do a very brief introduction. We are going to have a wonderful dialogue today with a dear friend, an old friend of mine from my medical school days at UC Davis, Dr. Kathy Morsay. She is one of the kindest and gentlest and most caring people that I remember knowing from medical school. And she has quite a journey. And she is currently working very actively and very hard to help the Native population in Gallup, New Mexico area where she lives. And so we'll introduce her more formally in a moment, but that's a little teaser about Dr. Kathy Morsay. And Nicole, before we dive in and talk about Native peoples, Indigenous peoples' health, I think we've been talking about this a bit together, and we wanted to start with talking about some data that we've discussed earlier with each other from an article that was published in PBS News in 2023, very recently, and it's called COVID-19 Shortened Native Life Expectancy, but it's not the only factor. And it was written by Dr. Allison Kelleher. I hope I pronounced her name right. And she states in the article that there's been a decline in life expectancy for Native and Alaska Natives since COVID-19. And that decline is 6.5 years based on an August 22 report from the National Center for Health Statistics. And this translates to an overall drop in average living years for Native people from 72 years of age in 2019 to only 65 years of age by the end of 2021 since COVID. And even though the pandemic is a major contributor for this decline, there was a discrepancy in life expectancy between the Native and the white community even before the pandemic. for instance, before 2020, the non-Hispanic white male population in the U.S. were expected to live 5 years longer than Native men. And so it's really quite a discrepancy. There are a lot of disparities that we'll try to get into some of the depths of it with Dr. Kathy Morsay today when we talk.
I'm so glad we're discussing these startling statistics involving the Indigenous community right here in the United States. It's still, reading the data out loud is just shocking. And so I'm glad we're really going through the data to set the stage for why this is such an important topic. Native and Alaskan Natives' mortality rates from diabetes are more than twice the rate for non-Indigenous populations. A report from the CDC shows that Natives have significantly higher rates of obesity, high blood pressure, cancers, and general poor health status compared to other Americans. Additionally, the suicide rate among Native communities is about 43% higher than that of non-Indigenous communities. And Native women experience sexual violence far more than non-Hispanic white women. This is just so, so sad and so shocking, and you can't argue with these statistics.
Right, Nicole. And it's such an important population we need to be talking about, because I feel like we need to give so much more respect and honor and gratitude to this population. There are so many disparities present that lead to poor health outcomes. For starters, poverty, unemployment, and lack of resources are huge issues. Natives have the highest poverty rate among all minority groups, with some statistics showing poverty rates as high as 25%. And unemployment among Native and Alaska Natives in November of 2022, which is very recently, was 6.2% compared to 3.7% in the general population. And many Indigenous people work only seasonally and are therefore woefully underemployed during the off seasons. Native and Alaska Natives are also underserved in the U.S. healthcare system. The Indian Health Service, which is the federal agency that provides medical care to Indigenous Americans, is funded at about $6 billion per year, which sounds like a lot of money, but that translates to only a little over $4,000 per person per year in 2021.
I am so glad we are talking about the Indian Health Service. As an emergency medicine physician-to-be, a lot of my colleagues and a lot of people that graduate from emergency medicine residency actually decide to spend some time beginning of their career working for the Indian Health Service. And so I think it's important to highlight that even though there are some new blood coming in, it is woefully underemployed and underfunded. As Shiva mentioned, the Indian Health Service is both understaffed and has access to fewer physicians, nurses, therapists, and therefore there's less resources going to see Native patients, and especially those patients that live in rural areas. Additionally, the Indian Health Service facilities often have fewer technologies available to them, such as MRI machines, ultrasound machines, which means that they're not able to get as fast or as accurate of diagnoses and treatment. Such shortages mean less access to either primary care or emergency care, which I'm sure also contributes to the lower life expectancy that we discussed earlier.
Yeah, so it feels a little heavy. This is a lot of data, and we don't usually start with that much data at the beginning, but we did want to set the stage, like you said, Nicole, for a background and really understand what we're about to talk with our special guests regarding today. And I want to introduce our guest. So Dr. Kathy Morsay is our guest today, who's someone who, as I mentioned, also happens to have been a classmate of mine way back when I, or really rather we, were at UC Davis School of Medicine. She has a very interesting background. She had started a successful career and had worked as a jeweler, a creative artistic endeavor and work. And then she started medical school at about the same time that her first two children entered adolescence. And that's pretty big already there as a second career and with kids. And she worked in Sacramento after graduating UC Davis Medical School for several years. And she volunteered in student-run free clinics, teaching, and she was seeing patients there. And then in 1999, when she was pregnant with her third child, she decided to return to live and raise her daughter in the Navajo Nation in New Mexico within the Four Sacred Mountains. She's currently a medical officer at the Gallup Indian Medical Center in New Mexico, And we're so happy to have the chance to catch up with her today and to talk about Native health and traditional healing. Welcome to Meaningful Medicine, Dr. Kathy Morsay.
Oh, thank you so much again for having me. I'm honored. And Shiva, I think you're absolutely wonderful. And you as well, Nicole, just met you. So I just want to take a moment to introduce myself traditionally, okay? Ye tachitni einishle, hotso dasha che, shije e anishinabi dosu nale nte. So as Navajo people, we're of four clans, and that is from our different ancestors, mother, father, maternal and paternal grandparents. And so I'm big people of the Red Running Into Water clan, which is inherited through my mother. And then my maternal grandfather is Meadow people. And then my father was Anishinaabe and Sioux. He was a non-Navajo, but still Native. And both of my parents were raised in New Mexico, myself in California. So I came here to New Mexico about 23 years ago. And yes, I work for the Indian Health Service. And I just have to say that what I'm saying does not represent their views. They're my own personal views and input.
Thank you so much, Dr. Morsay, for that wonderful intro. And we like to start out each episode by asking our guests to, in short, share a meaningful moment from early on in your training that was a particularly formative or defining experience.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And I actually have to back up earlier in my training, because this is the thing that really stands out to me is my decision in the first place to pursue medical training, which is what my parents wanted me to do right out of high school, but I just wasn't ready. I had to decide that for myself. I had decided to take a year off and go back after the birth of my first child, but then I found myself pregnant again. And pretty soon it was 10 years. And what had happened in that interim, in addition to being a jeweler, was that both of my children became mysteriously ill with severe allergies, multiple bouts of bronchitis, pneumonia, and ear infections that just seemed to be in sequence. And so I was often at the local Indian Health Service clinic, and I saw that a lot of the providers, there were very few of them, actually, they didn't seem to relate very well to the Native patients. And there was actually a dentist who worked there who was resentful that he worked there. And then the other influence was my mother-in-law, who was a nurse. She took me to presentations by doctors at the hospital, and I could see that she really thought well of them. And all of that together, I combined. And what ended up happening is between some of the information I got from the presentations at the hospital and from lots of reading on my own, I traced the problem of my children's illnesses to their beds. And once we got rid of those, it was like turning off a faucet. Everything dried up and they stayed well. And I decided then, okay, since they're well, now I have some time and this is what I want to do. So I reapplied to UC Davis and got in.
I think that's an amazing story. I really do have to ask, could you just tell a little bit about what was it about the beds? Because I think people are curious. What was it? Was it the material? Was there something toxic in it?
Oh, sure. There was something, although I never really understood what the mechanism was. So my husband and I bought brand new twin beds for both of our children. And this is when the problem began, when they were in their early elementary school years. And what I found out was that these beds had something called recycled man-made fibers. And in the process of learning about all of this and tracing that problem to them, I found out that this type of material was made from scraps that fell to the floor in clothing factories, where these big machines would cut many, many layers of fabric to make the clothing, and all of those scraps would fall to the floor. They were swept up and then processed into these rolls of kind of like a batting material that was used inside of mattresses. And so once we got rid of the mattresses, after putting the mattresses in zippered covers failed when the kids jumped on their beds and then they get these big holes and they get sick, start getting sick again. Well, they actually slept on cots with sleeping bags until we could afford to buy them new mattresses. And we made sure that they were 100% foam.
Dr. Morse, when you talked a little bit about your decision to come to medical school, can you talk a little bit about what that was like for you?
The good thing was that I left UC Davis in good standing in the beginning. So it was much easier to get back in. And now, yes, I had to really make sure that my kids helped out around the house and my husband had to help as well. But I think the big thing was that I was much more focused when I came back. My heart and my soul and my drive were towards this goal. And for that reason, I not only got through it, but I actually did far better when I returned to school than I did before I ended up dropping out.
It sounds like you found the new old passion in medicine and maybe some of your investigative work at home with the beds and the allergies sparked a little bit more in you. So I love hearing about that.
It sure did.
After you graduated and completed residency and after working for several years as a family physician in Sacramento, you decided to move to New Mexico. Can we ask what prompted this change and what did you hope to accomplish in the move?
Yes. Okay. Well, I became pregnant with my third child, as you mentioned, and that was a really big one for me. My first two were grown up, and with this third child that I was about to have, I thought about what I wanted for her, how I wanted her to be raised. I wanted her to be raised as a Navajo, and I wanted her to be born within our sacred mountains as Diné, as Navajo people. I always knew that I was going to serve Native people, but here was a chance to make that move to a place where it felt like home and where I would serve my own tribe. And so it was a big move, 6 months pregnant, but it worked out. And what I hoped to do was just to help serve as a doctor to my own people and in my own way to help improve this health status of my own people.
At the start of our episode, you were listening to, as Nicole and I were sharing some data about the health disparities, and it's just very disheartening data about the health of Native people. And wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you approach the kinds of health disparities that you're seeing in your community.
Sure. Well, as I said, serving my own people, and it turned out that a lot of my patients really loved that I was also Native, I was also Navajo, and they felt that they could really relate to me. In the Indian Health Service, we find ourselves as advocates for our patients in other ways. For instance, we often will write medical support letters for them to get services outside of our facility with various charitable and other governmental entities. And now that I'm a palliative care physician for the last 10 plus years, I really see and try to help patients decide their own goals of care, treatment, listen to them, and help to try the best that I can to mitigate the effects of poverty and bridging the culture. I was a member of the Traditional Medicine Committee for 18 years, and I started the palliative care program back in 2010. I'm also involved in some outside community projects, like the COPE program, Community Oriented Patient Empowerment Program. I'm a volunteer of their Patient and Family Advisory Committee as part of their Cancer Coalition. I'm a member of Gallup Solar, which receives grant funding, and the members apply to build a solar system and then donate that and set that up in various homes where there is no electricity, but there is a need for electricity, like for their medications. And then I have also volunteered with the University of New Mexico program called Thinking Zinc, which is involved in trying to study and hopefully help to mitigate the effects of uranium exposure and heavy metals from the coal mining.
Thank you so much for sharing. It sounds like you're tackling Indigenous health in so many different ways. We're talking about palliative care, which on an earlier episode, we discussed the importance of palliative care and how we truly believe it's a model for how medicine should be, really meeting patients where they're at, asking them what they want and what they need. And then you're going above and beyond by also looking at environmental factors and looking at and helping folks without electricity, trying to figure out creative ways to store refrigerated medications, which is just incredible. And I can imagine that given your wealth and breadth of how you serve your community, you have tons of different stories and tons of different patients that you interact with. Can you share some of your greatest successes and greatest challenges while working with the Indigenous population?
Yes, yes. So, of course, the poverty is a huge challenge. Also, that a third of the households lack running water, and about 30% of folks also lack electricity. There's long distances to anywhere. There's also nutritional factors as well. Because of the economy being what it is, many people have to travel. There's been breakup of the culture. They travel long distances to work or for health care. A lot of people don't grow their own food. Lots of, as you know, fast food and inappropriate food sold in gas stations and at the checkout lines in the grocery store. We're facing that here. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has designated the Navajo Reservation as a food desert. There's only about 13 grocery stores that are serving about 300,000 people, covering 27,000 square miles. So it's really tough for people to access fresh food, and that as well definitely affects their health. And I have a huge interest in nutrition, and all of my patients get nutrition education, and I also try to, as best I can, advise them on how to obtain more nutritious foods. So some of the successes, I actually had worried about whether or not I would be accepted among my own people. But I was told by other Native doctors, don't worry about that. The people will love you. And I found that to be true. It's been really gratifying to work with patients one-on-one, especially as a palliative care doctor, hearing from both patients and their families how I've helped them, especially at the ends of their lives. And just listening is a huge thing. And I do take time to listen to my patients. And I feel like in this setting, I do have some luxury to do that. Our palliative care team, and along with other departments, we took the lead in putting on two traditional healing ceremonies for COVID in September of 2020, and again in July of 2022. That was extremely well received.
I'd love to just follow up and ask you if you don't mind sharing a little bit more about what is involved in a COVID healing circle.
The traditional medicine evolved. Navajo traditional medicine is very structured and complex, and many, many ceremonies for different purposes. And they're generally done on an individual basis. And in this case, the institution was kind of considered more or less the patient. And a medicine man that used to work in our Office of Native Medicine kindly lent his guidance and support. And we actually put on more than just a healing ceremony. We had people within our institution, and even patients were invited during the first one to talk about how they survived COVID, to tell their story. And then people could pour out their sorrows through ceremony with pouring of water and blowing of ash on our site. And that was the traditional Navajo healing portion of it.
We really appreciate your describing that because it gives a visual for us who've not experienced traditional healing. And I wonder if we could just sort of talk a little bit more about traditional healing practices in your community and with the Navajo people. Could you talk a little bit about, kind of a broad question, but how do healers learn to become healers? And I know that's a very broad question. It might sound too simple. Second part of that, though, is also how did you learn to become with traditional healing practices, and what do you incorporate, and what are your favorite parts about it?
Well, first of all, I am not a traditional healer. People that come to visit the facility and they watch me when they shadow me, they think that on some level I'm doing traditional healing, and I'm not aware of it. We could consider part of the traditional healing just listening to people and giving them words of encouragement, which we should all be doing as doctors. I do refer people to medicine people that I know outside of our facility, but I also refer them to the Office of Native Medicine in our facility because we do offer some services, although they're not complete services, which is why I will often refer outside of our facility. So that I connect people with traditional healing, I guess would be a good way to put it. I have worked with many traditional healers over time. I have learned, I've picked up many things from them regarding ceremony protocol, how the healing works, a little something about that. I definitely don't know everything, and I'm definitely just scratching the surface. Now, as far as how healers, medicine people become medicine people, there's often traditional practitioners in the family of the medicine people. Many of them learn from a parent or a grandparent or some other relative. Others desire to get the training, and they will ask to apprentice with a medicine person and learn their ways, how they do ceremonies. In Navajo traditional healing, as I said, our ceremonies are pretty structured and complex, and some of our ceremonies have 400 or more songs in just one ceremony. So there's a lot to memorize, a lot to do. And there's a lot of specialization. Some medicine people will only diagnose, and we have several ways to diagnose, several modalities. And then others will both diagnose and treat, and some will only treat with ceremony. And usually a medicine person will memorize just a few ceremonies. They won't memorize everything. And some medicine people are herbalists, and they know the proper way of gathering and using herbs in all the dimensions of their use. And by that, I mean that herbs are thought to have both physical and spiritual properties, and they have to be gathered in a particular way in order to preserve that spiritual aspect.
A wonderful overview, and it's enough just to get us started and intrigued, I think. But I'm just wondering, as a general statement among your community, do you find that there's any resistance to, for example, Western antibiotics for treatments or things, as opposed to traditional treatments that might be similarly or more effective to their mind or experience?
It's a little complicated, okay, and it goes both ways. Natives, they understand the value of Western medicine. And many understand the value of traditional medicine. Many people have adopted Christianity, and depending on which church they belong to, some of their churches will tolerate the use of traditional medicine. Others are intolerant, and they will strongly discourage any use of traditional medicine because of the particular Christian beliefs of that church. And so some people will not want traditional medicine, and a few have even taken offense at that, from what I understand, although I haven't seen people necessarily take offense to that. I think if you ask in a sensitive manner, people will tell you. And then there are people that only want to use traditional medicine and not want to come to the clinic or the hospital. And then there's people that don't want any of it. And then there's people, of course, like I said, that will accept whatever help they can get. Many times when people are faced with a very serious illness, even if they are Christian, sometimes they will want to turn to traditional medicine as a last resort. Much like Western medicine, though, it's best if that is used earlier on in the course of an illness or a disease. So there's one story that I have, which I still smile about. And this is a former patient of mine who had a young medicine man in his family. And one of his patients, the family was very Christian and of a church that really did not like traditional medicine. But he really wanted to get well. He really wanted everything that both Western medicine and traditional medicine could offer him. And so usually ceremonies, because of their complexity, they will often require lots of help and assistance from extended family and community. However, it just wasn't available in this case. And so my patient's medicine man relative, they managed together as a family of this medicine person. They helped make it possible for this patient to get the ceremony done when his family was away, because he didn't want to face their disapproval. And that was considered a success. Like I said, it gets kind of complicated. And I truly believe there is a role for both Western medicine and traditional medicine in helping people.
I do think anytime you mix politics, religion, family, and medicine, there's always going to be some complications. But I appreciate you sharing that story. We discussed earlier, COVID has hit certain populations specifically hard, and that includes the indigenous population. COVID-19 death rates in the young, adult, and middle-aged population are 10 or more times as high in the indigenous population compared to the Caucasian population in 2020, and are about 4 to 5 times as high in 2021. And those indigenous folks who are above the age of 75, they experience death rates at approximately twice as high compared to their Caucasian counterparts. I'd love to hear how COVID-19, the pandemic, affected your community. And are there enough resources for support for COVID?
Yes, thank you for that question. As the New York Times put it, COVID tore through the Navajo Nation. Over 7,000 of my people died, over 50,000 cases. It was extremely challenging. It was heartbreaking to see what was happening to my people and to be walking down the hallway of a newly converted ward to watch my people on oxygen struggling to breathe and hearing the heartbreaking stories of families who lost more than one relative within days to weeks of one another, and often in different hospitals as well. Hearing people saying goodbye over Zoom from an iPad outside of their hospital, connected with their loved one. There are so many memories of that time. We did have a lot of additional support come in, and I am extremely grateful for various organizations, including some of the military divisions, the public health service. We had donations from charitable and private entities donating medical equipment, ventilators. We partnered with other institutions, such as the University of New Mexico by Zoom. Our palliative care team here partnered with them. We had regular meetings to help improve the care of our patients that were transferred there. Once they were put on a ventilator, we transferred them out. For a while, there was a hub that was in Albuquerque that knew where any open bed was in the state of New Mexico so that our patients could be transported out and find a bed for their best care. There were donations of iPads and a donation of a special Wi-Fi signal outside of our hospital where we could connect people with their loved ones. And so it really took a team, community-wide and system-wide and region-wide efforts, and even across the nation in some cases, to help come together, try to deal with the COVID pandemic.
I appreciate patient stories and reflections on individuals that you recall. It honors them in your heart and mind. And we talk about numbers, of course, because it kind of gives us a sense of the gravity and the depth and the breadth of the situation. But when you hear about individual people, somebody's father who is dying of respiratory distress and you can't even hear them or they don't have connections to talk to their family, that was really across the country huge throughout the peak of COVID. But in particular, in the Native community, I think, as you shared, especially devastating in sheer numbers and the experiences of limitations of resources. And as we think about that, you know, what we've been through so far, what your community particularly has been through, and obviously with such gratitude for a lot of the support that did come in. Looking ahead to the future, what do you think are the greatest changes that need to happen in order to kind of bridge the gaps to getting better health to your community, to the Indigenous Native people of our country?
That's definitely multi-pronged. We've needed a new hospital for quite a while. Our facility is 60 years old, and we are facing the limitations brought upon by an aging building that is frankly having problems that come up. The funding across the country needs to increase greatly. We also need, in addition to our facility, I'm sure there are other facilities that need upgrading or even replacement. I think that we also need to have some integrative medicine available to our patients, additional funding for traditional medicine services. We need to work on infrastructure such as running water and electricity for our communities, addressing poverty. We also need to provide some encouragement for resuming agricultural practices, which I think is going to really help at the grassroots level. Having food distribution centers in a number of areas on the Navajo Reservation where there are no grocery stores, so that people have access to fresh food. Our people didn't have many of the chronic diseases that we now see. Breast cancer, I was told, was rare in 1989 when I rotated through the facility in Fort Defiance. Now, every one of us has breast cancer patients, and we're losing some of them very young, even in their 20s. And I'm meeting people with a history of 2 or even 3 separate cancers. Cancer used to be rare. We also need to work on cleanup of the uranium tailings and waste sites, as well as heavy metals contamination. If you search the internet, like say, you know, Google, Safari, the largest nuclear disaster in the United States, 3 Mile Island is going to come up, but it wasn't. It was actually right here in Church Rock, just a few miles east of this community, east of Gallup, where I don't remember how many tons of uranium waste broke through a holding pond and was spilled into the Rio Puerco. The Rio Puerco is more of a seasonal river, and that still is affecting us now. Some of our patients, even though they have never smoked a cigarette in their life, are getting chronic lung disease, even though they never worked in the mines. The funding for the uranium miners' compensation actually has been stopped after a certain period of time. In the 1980s, it was felt that there was adequate respirator that could be used by the workers for prevention. But we have some people who grazed their livestock downstream from Church Rock that developed lung disease. And we also know that based on the Navajo cohort study from the University of New Mexico, that there is uranium contamination in the water of a community about 30 miles west of here in the Lupton area, and that children end up with an extremely high amount of uranium excreted in their urine at 1 year of age. And what we do also know is that in the beginning, there wasn't a lot of interest in studying and learning the effects that could happen from that spill, which occurred in 1979. And I think that was a mistake, but there are things being done now.
To be honest, it sounds like your community doesn't have what we consider basic needs in this country, which is safe running water, safe place to shelter, and a safe environment to do so. And so I do hope that this podcast can help elicit the country's concerns and really create movement and create policy to change what your community is currently experiencing. As we wrap up this podcast today, I'd love if you could share what advice you have for any students or trainees who are interested in Indigenous health.
I would say to meditate on it, pray on it, whatever your belief system is, because I think that when you get that inspiration, then things will become clear. Come out and visit us. I do have to admit that opportunities for students are not great because of our short staffing and our needs. We're more able to accommodate residents and fellows. And indeed, we do have a lot of palliative care fellows that rotate through our department, and we will also take on some residents. There is so much to see around here. There are so many beautiful sites that are historic, that have a lot of value, national monuments, national parks, there's petroglyphs, there's so much to see out here that have historical value, lots of sunshine, wide open spaces, and especially if you're an outdoors person. So yes, we do have a lot to offer, and I'm sure that anybody comes here will have a great experience and a great time as well.
Well, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast today, Dr. Marseille. We really appreciate everything you're doing for your community. And thank you so much for taking the time to really discuss the issues that are affecting the Indigenous communities and really sharing some things that I don't think are widely available to the public and are important issues that we should all care about. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, too. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you for tuning in today
and allowing us to be one of your meaningful moments.
Please rate, review, and subscribe, and share with friends, family, and colleagues. Meaningful Medicine was produced by Shiva Kayambashi, Nicole Hohenstein, David Elkin, Nikki Elkin, Ahaley Chattopadhyay, and Lei Kodama. Editing by Nicole Hohenstein, Nikki Elkin, and Lei Kodama. Intro and closing by Daniel Wendling. On Meaningful Medicine, we are careful to ensure that all stories are compliant with healthcare privacy laws, and details may have been changed to ensure patient confidentiality. All views expressed are of the person speaking and not their employer.